Well, hey, welcome, everybody. I'm Dave Krueger. I appreciate all the responses I've already received in regard to the two questions I sent around. You also have a link that I resent to you with the outline and resources and playback all at that link. That's where the playback will be posted. The outline is fairly annotated, so you shouldn't have to take many notes, and then the resources might be something that will be a benefit to you. Now, I'm really excited. This seminar series is one of my favorite things I do all year, and I really appreciate the responses that you've sent for the couple of questions. What's the most important thing you want addressed during this seminar series about this topic? And 4 weeks from now, what do you want to walk away with? It helps me. Could I get a management of background noise? Anything you do, even if you breathe, is picked up by your microphone, certainly when you move anything or even walk across the room with a headset. And there are a bunch of people, and thank you very much for that. Thanks for the responses you've sent. It helps me to get an idea of how to shape some of our conversation and some of the things I include to know what your interests and challenges in this area are and the application of coaching. And I take those responses seriously, and I'm going to incorporate them. Again, a mute, please, if you're not ready to talk, star six. I'm going to reserve a portion of our time at the beginning, sort of brief, but at the beginning and the end for discussion. And I want to keep an open mic because I'd like to hear your questions, responses, and clarifications. So if you'll manage the background noise, we can keep it open. And then I'll go to a lecture mode when I do the presentation part, but then we'll come back and have a discussion at the end again. So I encourage those of you who haven't responded to those questions to do so. Now, you'll notice most likely the parallel of these two questions with how we frame each session with a client. And I'm assuming most of you have trained at CTA to determine what the client wants to focus on and what they'd like to take away. Collaboration follows a model similar to this for what we're doing and familiar to most of you.
Now,
these questions form a map that we co-create with the client to determine where they are, where they want to go, how to measure progress along the way, and what's deter and distraction. So with a map, it's really important because of all the stuff you don't have to pay attention to. Same with the one thing you focus on. It eliminates millions of other possibilities. So I'm going to make a suggestion in just a moment about how you frame this series for yourself first before you begin to apply it to clients. But I want to ask, are there any other responses to those questions or anything you'd like to add or ask at the beginning while we're still in a discussion mode? I really appreciate the questions that have already been sent in. They're really some excellent questions, and I think I have my work cut out for me, but we're gonna develop a number of things together, and I will definitely incorporate the specific things that each of you have. You'll recognize it. I may deal with some directly and may just incorporate some in the discussion. Anything else you'd like to add or ask at the beginning? Or just say hi so I don't get too lonely. Anybody want to check in? I know there are a lot of people on the line.
Hi, Dr. Dave.
Thank you.
Hi, Dr. Krueger.
All right, I'll keep talking to you if you call me Dave.
Hi there, Dr. Dave.
Okay, I feel better already. All right, good. You've cured me. Okay, I'm gonna. Are there any specific questions or things you'd like to add or ask at this point, anyone? Well, I'm gonna put us on presentation mode and then introduce our topic and move through our first seminar, And I'm very interested in your responses and how this sounds to you and what's familiar and what's not. So hold on, we're going to go on lecture mode. You won't have to worry about background noise. So our first seminar is going to be on the dynamics and developmental stages of both change and transition. I think that's important for us to understand as a coach. Now, this is for you. This is training. This is not how you're going to talk to your clients, but this is so you'll have a conceptual framework. And the metaphor of story is something we use as coaches, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. But it's not for the client, your client. They're not telling you a story. They're telling you how it is. They're telling you their reality. Their beliefs are not beliefs. That's just how it is. So remember, it's our metaphor that we use to organize, to make sense of things, and to create a developmental flow for each coaching session and each coaching engagement. So my suggestion and challenge to each of you, before you start thinking about or applying these notions to your clients, consider how your story, personally and professionally, has changed in the last 2 years with the pandemic and since you're beginning training as a coach. And then later, how it applies to your work with clients. But wait until at least day after tomorrow, because I'm going to give you enough stuff to think about for minimum a full day to start with. So first, let's talk about the dynamics and developmental steps of change and transition. That's this seminar. So first, think about, what's your story? When we want someone to know who we are, we share stories, maybe of our childhoods, our families, or what's important to us. When we know people well, we know their stories and what shaped and molded them, the trials and turning points that have tested them. Our own story is a significant and powerful organizer of our experiences. It's a continuity of where we've been, where we are now, and where we'll go. Stories define, orient, and guide us. And a good story is never more necessary than at the time of change and transition, a time that's unsettling, confusing, uncertain, insecure. And think about the last couple of years. There's no script for that. You couldn't have planned for that. The ability to craft a good story at a crucial time is significant to the success of everything that will follow. We learn through stories, we use stories to understand, to make sense of things, and to remember. A good story bridges the past and present to make sense of where we are, where we were, and the uncertain future. A critical element of our well-being is how we understand what happens to us and why. And some approaches derail because they attempt to change someone's behavior without considering what it does to their personal stories and their identity. We're going to return to the importance of identity because that's the very bedrock of someone's essence and sense of self. It's also the foundation of whether the changes that you help someone make will become permanent or not. More on that later. The change is the event, the situation. You move to a new city, divorce, retire, have a significant loss, take a new job, lose an old one, change careers. As we focus on change, we address the rituals of change, the work tools, the strategic goals, perhaps. So here are some ideas about the dynamics of it. This is in your outline. I suggest you print it so you can really listen and see if what I'm saying makes sense to you. First, the idea of change will create some anticipation, maybe uncertainty, even anxiety. Then, as it's more on the cusp of action, a real trepidation and more crystallized uncertainty and anxiety. Next, if you continue rather than return to your comfort zone, expansion into the new experience. Then, finally, mastery. Now, there are a couple of additional aspects of experiencing change that may seem paradoxical, but I want to just present them so you can log them in, because you're going to hear these from your clients. And it's not something to directly coach, but it can be an organizer in your mind. Every step forward means relinquishing a past position. Someone must mourn. They must say goodbye emotionally as well as practically to a familiar, especially the long-held and practiced old story, even one that doesn't work that well. This is a process, a developmental step. It's not something you can just say and make it so, or recognize it and change it. It's like saying goodbye to an old friend, to give up a habit, even when it doesn't work that well, or a pattern of behavior, or a hope that by getting the old story just right, or doing it better, that's going to make it work. Secondly, the more subtle aspect in learning something new and creating change is an injury to self-esteem. Now, this seems kind of paradoxical, but this carefully crafted old story with aspects of identity is replaced by something better. And that's the narcissistic injury, because you recognize that, man, all this time I could have been doing way better. Why didn't I recognize? Keep that in mind. So there are six, as I see it, I'm going to talk about it with you, six components in the dynamic of change. These are not headlines. Now, you're not going to see signs that you can label, and these are not things your client's going to tell you, but these are just for your reflection to think about, kind of like maybe an internal conceptual marker. One, the myth that there is a perfect choice. The illusion that the perfect choice will solve all problems. The disappointment that nothing is really perfect. And here's the ultimate blow called adulthood, to put it in scientific terms. There isn't even an ultimate arbiter of fairness. The development. This is the second part of adulthood. The recognition that no one is going to take care of it for you. The growth to take the next best action. And finally, the consolidation. The happy-sad combination that always doesn't make sense the first time. Happy about the effectiveness of not creating an obstacle to move ahead. The experience of mastery, but sad about mourning the old story. Every transition begins with an ending, a change event. And we have to let go of the old before we can begin the new. Every beginning ends something. And as Agnes Allen, American writer, said, almost anything is easier to get into rather than out of. Changing to a better job or career may ironically cause a similar grief and confusion as the sad end of an important relationship in the past. And that, on the surface, doesn't make sense always, initially at least. The reason it's important to recognize is that some of the feelings you experience today may have nothing to do with the present ending, but come from the resonance with similar situations and endings in the past. Letting go is difficult. Herodotus, Greek historian in the 5th century BC, said this, "Diseases most always attack men when they are exposed to change." Even when we look forward to a change, anticipate it eagerly, some of us still hold on to what used to be, and we wonder whether the change was a good or bad idea. We're defined, and we define ourselves, by our roles and relationships, those we like and those we don't. So letting go is an ambiguous experience. New skills are needed for negotiating the passage, separating the old from the new. The characteristic ways of coping with endings need to be understood. Each person has his or her own style of ending and new beginning. I want to talk about this for in just a moment, but I want to give you an illustration of where I, in some ways, profoundly recognize this principle that I'm talking about giving up even a bad habit is like giving up an old friend because you're so familiar. Your brain has habituated to the standard way of doing things. It's hardwired to become the default mode. When I first recognized this was back in the day when I practiced psychiatry, psychoanalysis, and had one of the first eating disorder treatment programs in the country. I saw so many young women who had the same story. That it was. This was back in the day in the 80s before people knew what eating disorders was. So everybody was kind of independently discovering it. Every young woman I saw who had bulimia had a struggle with giving it up because she was so familiar with it, and it became like giving up a good friend. It was the one thing that she could rely on to regulate her state of mind, to calm herself in some way. So it was like she knew she needed to do it, but it was like giving up a good friend, and it required mourning of gradually saying goodbye to something that had always been there when nobody and nothing else had been there. It truly was like a best friend, and it had become an identity. So the change and the transformation from that way of thinking and doing and seeing herself all the way to her identity was part of that transition of change. Now, each person has his or her own style of ending a new beginning, and we tend to respond to endings in our own typical way, to have reactions that are characteristic to each of us. Here are a few of the more common styles of ending. Abrupt, designed to deny the impact and the feeling and the meaning of change often. Slow and gradual, so that it's kind of difficult to see that anything important is really happening. An external focus, and these are not mutually exclusive, by the way, I can tell you. An external focus. Some people learn to cultivate a subtle way of covertly inviting people to act on them when they know they need to change or when change is in the air. Active or passive, proactive or reactive. Some people work to establish blamelessness in regard to endings. She just walked out. No warning, no nothing. She just left me. It's kind of like someone who shouts really quickly, "I didn't do it," when the police arrive, calls attention, and makes everybody suspicious of that blurt. So how you approach change comes from the style you've developed for dealing with endings, and this is something you can become aware of. That style is likely to reflect early experience as well as later influence and be consistent over time and situation. It becomes an attachment pattern. This is something I hadn't thought about, but I'll send you guys it's a white paper that I did earlier on attachment patterns, because I think it's the first attempt that I was familiar with of applying this substantial body of work and research to coaching, and I think it might be helpful, and I'll make a note to do that. Typically, someone repeats a behavior pattern. As with other important losses, one person feels the grief and anxiety for the entire group, another comforts the mourner, another takes over the routine responsibility, another assumes control for the situation. I've just described a prototypical family dynamic here. Although it's advantageous to understand your own style of endings, a part of you will resist that understanding with passion. We're not talking about just the big endings here, divorce, career transition, job loss, children leaving for college, retirement. Even the small endings have their own personality that's consistent with the big endings. Think about how you tend to act at the end of an evening at a friend's house or after a night on the town. Do you drag things out by starting new activities and conversations when others seem to be ready to leave? you suddenly say that it was a nice evening and abruptly dash out? Did you say goodbye to everyone or leave ahead of plan so you could avoid the goodbyes? Notice how the small and the large endings can be a similar pattern, leaving a job or moving from a neighborhood, as well as having dinner with friends. The person who leaves early and the one who stays late both avoid endings in their own way, as well as the discomfort of that disruption and transition. A dasher and a lingerer share the same dynamic. There are things we don't want to happen but have to accept. Things we don't want to know but have to learn. People we can't live without but have to let go. It's the ending that makes the beginning possible. So here are some principles of letting go. This is in your outline. And these are with application to consider for coaching. Accept the reality as well as the importance of the subjective losses, the meanings of the losses. Acknowledge the loss openly. Accept and expect overreaction. This is an emotional event, after all. Overreaction because the emotional impact of the loss, as well as past experiences with losses, both kind of amalgamate in the present moment. Expect and accept the process of grief and each of its stages, anger, bargaining, anxiety, sadness, then disorientation and confusion. And they're not always in that order. They have many possible permutations in different orders. Compensate for the losses. Ask, what can I give back to balance what's been taken away or lost? Learn as much as possible about the loss in order to benefit from it. This is something we will return to. How you frame something determines the mindset that you use to boot it up. So if you look at a loss, you know, what's the opportunity? What's the challenge? Instead of what's the problem? This is what we do in coaching, the choice architecture of the present moment, to frame something, to look at what's next and how can we see this in a positive and adaptive way. Define what's over and what isn't over. Mark the endings rather than just talking about the endings. Create actions or activities that dramatize them. For example, when Rene McPherson took over the leadership of Dana Corporation, he saw that operations were choked by a culture of rules that nobody could remember or mostly not even understand. In a management meeting, he piled all the company manuals on a table. This was his first meeting after he took over. They formed a stack almost 2 feet tall. Then he pushed them to the floor and held up a single piece of paper on which the corporate principles were typed. He said, here are our new operating principles. Treat the past with respect. Consider taking a piece of the old story with you. Endings ensure the continuity of what really matters, and the past, so-called the good old days, will be idealized at times, denigrated at times. The changes anyone experiences are different than anything they've ever experienced before. The transition process by which people get through change is a system, and it can be mapped. This is what we know in coaching. If you want to help someone change, don't focus just on the goal. Focus on the system. Think about how you create a system with each coaching session. What would you like to focus on? Where would you like to get to at the end of our session to take away? That's the map. When you have a map, again, you know where you are, where you're going. You can measure progress along the way. And the beauty of a map is all the stuff you don't have to pay attention to. You can tell what's detour and what's distraction. And you actively guide someone during that time as a coach to get to their destination. You're not ghostwriting the story. You're a catalyst for their story. So let's talk about the dynamics of transition now. The change event is the snapshot. The change process may be the wide-angle view, but the transition is the dynamic time-lapse photograph. The transition is the process of the internal story of change. It includes a shift in orientation, even self-definition. Transition is awareness of the seasonal cycles while attending to the daily weather. As you respond to change and embrace transition, you gradually let go of the old story, the outlived chapter, and evolve into your new story. Remember, this is about you first. Don't start applying it to clients. Keep it with you for right now and see if it makes sense. You transform a new identity to internalize changes in order to sustain and enhance them. This is what makes change permanent. We'll keep coming back to that. The transition story provides the coherence that will reassure in the present as well as foreshadow the future. The person you were yesterday is the person you are today, and the person you will be tomorrow, only more so. Yet, seemingly paradoxically, old stories need to be mourned, and along with them, the self left behind. One of my favorite authors put it this way. She never felt more like a little girl than at the very moment she recognized she was no longer one. You have your own characteristic way of a new beginning, just as with endings. Change and renewal seems to involve perhaps new relationships. They can also involve new places or projects. For some, it begins with a new state of mind, a new feeling, self-image, goal. Sometimes, the beginning results from careful and conscious effort. But for a number of people, important new beginnings may have a mysterious and sometimes accidental quality to them. Although we think we take charge of our lives and plan carefully to start again after an ending, some of the most important beginnings take place in the unfocused darkness outside our awareness. For example, 2 years after my divorce, I was at an author's conference in Austin. I was planning to leave Saturday. After the last conference meeting, I had carefully calculated I just had enough time to drive to my ranch between Austin and Houston to catch the sunset. One of the measures of the quality of my life is the number of sunsets I'm at the ranch. On the porch with a couple of riding companions, a cigar and a single malt, watching the sunset over the lake and trees. But I decided for some totally unknown reason to stay for the social hour, a wine and cheese event. Nothing to compare to my single malt, by the way. Never mind the cigar and the sunset. There I met my future wife. 2 years later, we married on that porch that I didn't get to that evening for sunset, a sunset with her children and mine attending for the wedding. That was 17 years ago. If you call my office number, it's her greeting you hear. That was when that's another story about what she's up to these days. We'll talk about that if you're interested. Without a transition, change simply rearranges the furniture. People imagine that they can prepare for retirement by making specific changes, like adequate financial preparation, a place to live, developing new interests. Yet the challenge is the transition. A change only prepares you for the transition. People have to let go of the outlived chapters of their lives and find a new one to replace it, or the outlived chapters of a business story to create a new one. At times, rituals and celebrations further the process of transition, as well as serve as markers. Every lifetime has its own unique rhythm, its own personal developmental steps for both change and transition, and these deserve attention for each person. Transition is a process. It takes time. No matter how many people you put on the job, it still takes 9 months to have a baby. So here are three components of transition. First, there's an ending. Then a neutral zone, an important time that's not with a specific direction necessarily, that's in between, filled with mourning, with work, with getting ready. And then you finish with a new beginning. Let's look at these, because you're going to see these developmental steps for transition. You're going to be catalyzing them for your client as they develop their own story. First, the ending. Every transition begins with an ending. Even though it sounds backwards, endings always come first. Willingly or unwillingly, an ending. The first task is to let go, whether an individual or an organizational level, whether the source of transition is an external change or an internal development or growth, the transition always starts with an ending. Think about, for example, when you began your professional coach training. That was the beginning of an entirely new professional training, engagement, and identity. To start doing things a new way, you have to end the way you're doing them now. The most common mistake is to add a new pattern to the one that already exists. The impact of the transition doesn't necessarily bear a direct relationship to the importance of the change that triggered it. One person can be brought to an abrupt standstill by a divorce or job loss, while another person takes it in stride. Someone else may come to terms with a debilitating illness, yet be demolished by the loss of a pet. Here's one way, one dramatic way to mark an ending in a story. Spanish explorer Hernando Cortes came ashore with his men at Veracruz, and he knew that his men were extremely reluctant about the exploration ahead, scared of unknown enemies. They knew potential danger. Some had called it hopeless. So faced with a continent full of unknown adversary, each person in his party was really ambivalent, really scared about moving ahead or turning back. Cortes burned the ships. Here are some components of the ending process. There are about five aspects of an ending experience as I see it. One is disengage, and these are not necessarily in order, and I'll talk about that, but they can be. Okay. First is disengagement. Usual events disengage from the context and the identity in which someone knows themselves. Think about a divorce, a death, a job change, a move, an illness. A disengagement begins a process of change. Another, dismantling. Old familiar behaviors and habit practices are taken apart a piece at a time. This gradual transition involves slowly unpacking, let's say, a lost relationship, including the lost identity. That's part of it. An ending stops what used to be. It's not the old way anymore, but not yet the new way that's really familiar as this dismantling occurs. It can be, for example, not inheriting most of your friends when you divorce, he said with some sensitive recollection. Three, disidentification. Ending connections with what used to be, you also lose an old way of defining yourself. Those old friends you didn't inherit in the divorce. Often people describe this phase as not being quite sure who they are. I thought about this a good deal when I came to terms with the early retirement from my practice of teaching psychiatry and psychoanalysis to become a mentor coach. For 25 years of practice, even though I had planned this, and I'd planned this from the last third of my, I'd planned this specifically. 7 years prior to that 25 years, medical school and residency, I identified with being a doctor. I even wondered if using the MD after my name was a way of hanging on to that identity, although I clearly knew I was no longer practicing, nor would I ever return to it. An old identity can potentially stand in the way of transition as well as transformation and self-renewal, or it can serve as a foundation and a springboard. Four, disenchantment. Coexisting with a still vivid picture of the way things are is a split-screen image of the way things were. Disenchantment may be discovering that in some sense your world is simply no longer the way it used to be. Think about your experiences with COVID, each of you. Disenchantment is a recurrent experience throughout the lifetime of anyone who has the courage to trust and believe in the first place. Some significant transitions began with disenchantment, the loss of a job, the loss of a relationship, the loss of our sense of invulnerability individually and socially with COVID. Listen for this possible distinction in your clients. The disenchanted person moves on, while the disillusioned person goes through the play again with new actors, always on a perpetual quest for the elusive, not letting go and trying to hang on or reestablish the past. And five, disorientation. This can affect a sense of place or space as well as time. The usual way of structuring time changes. The future is unclear. Now, these elements are not always in sequence nor any particular order. For example, in a divorce, one partner may experience disidentification and disorientation and then decide to act, which leads to disengagement. So if you're scoring that play, it's 3-5-1. The other partner, unaware of the impending change, begins and ending with disengagement and the challenge of disenchantment, and then becomes oriented. That's 1-4-5. There's no normal or natural order to this sequence, nor is there any normal order of reactions to an ending. Endings are the first rather than the last act of the play. Notice that the first one, disengagement, refers exclusively to external things. The second, dismantling, can be either internal or external, but the last three, disidentification, disenchantment, disorientation, they're all internal. It's the internal things that hold us onto the past, yet we often try to deal only with the external issues, but that gives a sense of some kind of control or mastery, something we can focus on instead of this vague other stuff. This focus can use change to avoid transition, to storm out of a job because of a bad boss, rather than discover that it keeps you finding and agreeing to work for such bosses, to end another relationship rather than letting go of the behaviors, beliefs, and attitudes that you keep choosing the wrong person and reentering the same relationship with different faces. Remember your friend from college who had numerous relationships? Yet the dozens of faces were on the same woman or the same man. After someone struggles initially with the change, then begins to grapple with the transition, this is the true work, the beginning of the transformation. So the mid-phase is the neutral zone, a resistance to transition, often a part of giving up a job or a relationship, even an identity. The real problem is the time of nothingness that awakens old fears about abandonment and death. People in transition will create new ways to return to the old story. It's how we're hardwired. We want to return to the familiar. There's always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. Every ending is followed by some distress or confusion. We can expect this as part of a transition. Ending, confusion, new beginning. People will resist both the change and the transition. They will return to the familiar. So we can reframe this return to the familiar as a way of ensuring or measuring progress to see how far you've come, an opportunity to validate your commitment to move forward. This in-between time of transformation is the real work of letting go and prepares the foundation for the next stage. So it's important not to rush through this neutral phase or zone, rather, too quickly in order to avoid or minimize the disruption. It's a very important time for this work and process. When I went through my career transition, I needed a time in between before I began my new career. I knew I was a medical professional in my mind and heart, and I would be tempted to revert to that old identity and style of being if I was in doubt about this new endeavor about coaching, which is why I made a wholesale transition and to retire completely from my medical practice, to close that in every way, then to spend some time at my ranch writing and physically working as I began training for certification as a professional coach. Now, in another era, I didn't realize what a caveman I was. The person in transition left the village and went into a forest or desert to remain for a time, removed from the old connections and without old identities. The old reality changed in time and changed as well. This in-between time of empty space fostered the generation of a new sense of self. When someone doesn't allow this essential period of time to create a transition, to let it marinate, important work can be avoided. If it's treated like an event, like crossing a street, a necessary process may be averted. And often somebody, without even quite knowing why, finds ways of being alone and away from familiar distractions. Sometimes it's a long weekend alone in a quiet place, having the time to think things over, to not do much of anything. That's the point. Competence begins to lose its force as a source of motivation over time. To do the same thing over and over becomes less challenging, less invigorating. The brain also plays a role in this. Dopamine is the brain chemical that induces excitement by anticipating what's next, the pleasure or the reward. This rush from dopamine motivates people to do various things, to try something new. But neuroscientists have shown that anticipating a reward is actually the event that creates the dopamine release. And then receiving the reward, or doing it then, actually shuts down this anticipatory release of dopamine, along with the accompanying positive feelings and high energy, because the brain shifts from this sprint system of dopamine to the marathon system of norepinephrine primarily. This explains the paradox that the expectation of an event is usually more exciting than the actual event. For example, the purchase of a big ticket item, a new car that you've been waiting for a long time, may not quite be as exciting as you expected. Or think about clients. Hit a plateau after coaching in 1 to 2 months and consider suspending work. This is going to help you help them through this transition process. What we can do in coaching is to foster attitudes that promote curiosity, openness, see the big picture, the transition process, and introduce new learning to ladder challenges and successes. And by knowing this phenomenon, we can address and explain it as an understandable development. So here are two questions to focus on the meaning of transition at a particular time in life. One, what is it time to let go of in my life right now? Transition starts with letting go. The answer may be usually something internal, subjective, often in the shape of an idea or a question you ask yourself. It may feel like a message to you, a message that's something standing just outside the door of awareness, waiting for your attention. You have to deal with endings. We have to all of our lives, yet curiously we often handle them poorly. We either take them too seriously by confusing them with finality, or we see them as something without sequel, forgetting that we're simply in this first phase of a transition process and a necessary precondition of self-renewal. So at the same time, we feel we fail to take them seriously enough because they scare us, and we may try to avoid them. It's not the loss of someone that creates problems, but the failure to internalize that person in relationship. For some, their present consists at least in part of a past they've not quite let go of yet. Here's an illustration of the emptiness of this neutral zone in Leo Tolstoy's description. I felt that something had broken within me, which my life had always rested on, that I had nothing left to hold on to, and that morally my life had stopped. And yet I could give no reasonable meaning for any action of my life, and I was surprised that I had not understood this from the beginning. My state of mind was as if some wicked and stupid jest was being played upon me by someone. I asked myself, what will be the outcome of what I do today? What shall I do tomorrow? What will be the outcome of my life? Why should I live? Why should I do anything? The reasons for this emptiness between the old life and the new include the process of transformation is essentially a death and rebirth process, not a mechanical modification. And the process of disengagement and reintegration is the source of renewal, just the way an apple tree needs the cold of winter. The emptiness between the stages of a life journey provides a perspective on the stages themselves. This in-between time provides access to a view, a perspective that can occur nowhere else. So a very brief summary of the creative use of this neutral zone. Embrace setbacks, losses, disadvantages as entry points into new solution. Establish appointments with yourself, a regular time and place to be alone, to step back, to reflect, to take stock. Provide opportunities for others important in your change and transition to step back and review as well. Accept your need for this time in the neutral zone. It's a process, not an event. Engage in various things like training and techniques of discovery and innovation. Activate your growth mindset instead of letting it lie dormant. Become involved about the change and the transition process, what you're doing and what you're doing now, and how this is going to help your clients do it. Take this opportunity to discover what you really want. Maybe engage in experimentation. Try something new or different. Keep a log of this neutral zone experience. Take this pause in the action of your life, perhaps, to write your own autobiography. Think of what would be unlived in your life if it ended today. We're going to come back to that. Reflect consciously on the present transition experience in your own life, the neutral zone, the time between the old and the new. Is a rich time for that insight. So, let's talk just a little bit about three. You finish with a new beginning. A new beginning follows the ending, and the new beginning involves changing how you see yourself, even aspects of your identity. We may not always know when the ending is complete, and when we've been in the neutral zone long enough, especially when the path is a genuinely new beginning. For a time, we may not even know what the real path is. Think about the important beginnings in your own past. You bumped into an old friend you hadn't seen for years, and he told you about a job at his company that opened up that morning. You met your spouse to be at a party you really hadn't wanted to go and almost skipped. You picked up a book that changed your life because there's only one lying on the friend's coffee table when you drop by for an unexpected visit. The lesson in these experiences is that when you're ready to make a new beginning, you'll find an opportunity. When you're ready to learn, a teacher will appear. There will be a wine and cheese event somewhere. New beginnings often occur with an internal realignment rather than an external shift. When we're aligned with our needs and ideals, our deep longings, our purpose. Each step forward may set off an inner warning system. That's the job description of your brain. The brain's error detection mechanism will read, this isn't what I expected. This is not a signal to return to the old way of being, even though it may create an immediate comfort. Never underestimate the change back pressure from the system, beginning with your brain and your mind software of wanting to stay in the familiar, even though it's not working. Your family, your company, it's their self-statement of reaction to change. It's an attempt to do you a favor, to restore normal order and not do the work of change. It's the collective error detection mechanism of any group. A group or a system has a status quo bias and inertia, as well as individuals do. Jung said, the most important problems can't be solved. They have to be outgrown. The most important distinction here is this. Have you really moved through the endings and the neutral zone to find the beginning that you now want to follow? Or is this beginning a way of avoiding or ending or aborting the neutral zone experience? One thing you can do is to begin to identify yourself with the final result of the new beginning. What is it going to feel like when you've actually done what you're setting out to do? That's the most basic desire that we have as human beings, is we do what we do because we imagine how it's going to feel. We understandably have ambivalence about new meaning. We haven't established a comfort zone, not grooved a default mode in our minds and brains, and we don't know the outcome. But be sure you don't read that natural trepidation as intuition that this is not the right thing or your gut's telling you it's wrong. This is simply a read of something new and different, of a signpost reframed, that you're in new territory. So beginnings may reactivate some old anxieties as well as making it very real that the ending is really happening or has happened. The risk and uncertainty of the new beginning will resonate with past anxiety, perhaps even trigger old memories of failures, and a new beginning will erode the equilibrium of the neutral zone. For example, one of the most challenging aspects of being an adult and taking care of ourselves is that we have to come to the end of the past, the hope that someone else is going to do it for us, as I mentioned. And it's more difficult to let go of what never was than even what was traumatically so, because you give up hope of ever having it exactly in the way that you wanted it. And with it, the illusion that there's an ultimate arbiter of fairness. New beginnings need to have a clear sense and idea of purpose. To reinforce a new beginning, you'll have to evolve a new identity that replaces the old one. In the beginning, take things step by step to recognize the assumption and resist the temptation that some other route would go smoothly, with events always exciting and meaningful. It's like comparing yourself with someone else. You're comparing your inside with their outside. That's never an apples-to-apples comparison. It's important in a new beginning not to be preoccupied with results. Focus on the system. This is an important aspect of a new beginning. Every transition is a transition from something into something. Each of these transitions corresponds to internal change, an integration, ultimately, of a new identity with elements of the old, metabolized, but they look and feel different. There are many endings, many little beginnings, with emptiness and creation in between. There are very few times we actually have direct contact with our future selves. We seldom review our present circumstances as they might appear to a relative objective future self. When we plan ahead, look around the corner, we specify goals rather than future development of identity or even states of mind. This may, in a way, contribute to looking back at our own past with a bit of alienation or disbelief, almost as if somebody else lived it. Exceptions occur at certain moments in life, perhaps prompted by the excitement of a major event, that we may look ahead in time and think, I'll remember this moment forever. This awareness seems to change present experience, to enhance it with a special lighting and a sharp focus. So there are some considerations to reinforce this new beginning. Be consistent. Have a system and shrink the change to ensure stepwise successes. Celebrate small successes. Evolve a new identity. In 10 or 20 years, when we look back on present time, laced among experiences will inevitably some envy and regret will be there. We envy the younger self who could relatively do so much more, and we'll regret that the younger self did not do more. Did not invest in Apple in 1987. I divert, though. We may wonder why we learned too little, loved too much, risked too low, and spent too much time in routine and distraction. This view from a future self looking back to the present can be very informative in. So two things I want to end with, and then reserve some time, although it's briefer than I thought or hoped. A question and a challenge. Here's the question. I'd recommend that you get very comfortable and close your eyes, take a deep breath to breathe in relaxation, and breathe out any tension. Now with your eyes still closed, imagine a photograph of you 100 years from now. When your great-grandchildren look at that picture, what's the story you most want them to tell about you? Now, another deep breath, in for relaxation, breathe out any tension, wipe the slate clean, get very relaxed, keep your eyes closed, because this is the challenge. What if right now is a turning point for you? The time your grandchildren will tell stories about years from now. The time you awakened your deep passion and acted on it. The time you did what you were always meant to do. Or, this moment of truth may be a brief awakening, silenced by the sensible obstacles you're familiar with constructing. In that case, your grandchildren will have to be content telling stories about your favorite sports team or what great cookies you used to bake. It will all depend on how brave you'll be. Okay, we're in discussion mode now. I'm interested in any clarifications, responses of what you're taking away, or questions that you'd like to have us talk about briefly?
I have a question.
I'll talk to you if you tell
Nicole
me your
Bailey.
First name.
Yes, my name is Nicole Bailey.
Great. Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
When you were talking about the dynamics of transition, the first part was the ending. You mentioned that the internal is what keeps us holding on to the past.
Yes.
So are you saying that this phase, the five components, this is the internal, this is what goes on internally?
Okay, here's my best shot at that answer and how it applies to coaching. One of the things that you can best come to know about your client as you began is what's important to them, what their purpose is. In other words, to know their needs and their ideals, what their most important needs are, what their most important ideals are, and incorporate those into your game plan of strategy and goals. So, yes, the answer is to be very attuned to your needs and to your ideals, your values, because that's the true north, the purpose. And when you're meeting your needs and living into your ideals, that's when you see the best result. In fact, the only place that I know that self-esteem comes from is from having attainable ideals and living into them. The antithesis of that is when you don't live into your ideals, shame is the result. Not guilt, because that's the transgression of a sense of right or wrong. But those are the important things of the foundation of how to move forward and what you really want to know to be sure that you're working with your client to have those needs and ideals and their goals and strategies all aligned so that all of them's going in the same direction. Does that make sense and answer your question, at least in a beginning way?
Yes.
We're going to return to that because it's a great question and a really fundamental one. So, yes.
Okay.
But and
thank
to
you.
Be continued with that. And thank you for jumping in with
okay.
that. Who else? What other questions, thoughts, additions?
Hey there, Dr. Dave. It's Jeanette McGee.
Welcome. Hey, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Great. What you got?
Great. Great class today. So my question to you to follow up on Nicole's question, I think, is that that sort of primal reptilian brain control over our habits and our thoughts, like where we program ourselves subconsciously to, you know, follow a script that's safe, like just and stay in the safe zone, right? So is that where that transition phase is the crucial, like, resetting of the subconscious script?
Basically, the answer is yes, because what you're speaking of is that what we know now is that 90 to 95% of our operating system is unconscious. So mm-hmm. all of the aspects of that system are what contribute to creating a story. So mm-hmm. we're, you know, what that means also is that we don't ever have to explore our unconscious. Every algorithm is going to be relived in present thought and feeling and behavior. And an algorithm, as you know, is a finite series of steps used to solve a problem or enhance performance. We're going to see evidence of exactly how our client creates a story. That's what comes alive in the process. And the client is going to show us exactly what it's like to be him or her so that we will know, with a collaborative alliance looking together, at what may need to be changed, what may need mm-hmm. to be enhanced, or what may need to do, the client may need to do more of. So, mm-hmm. And remember, our client is not telling us a story. They're telling us how it is, their experience. So we mm-hmm. listen for what we hear and all the things that go into that operating system that's not so conscious, and all the way to being totally unconscious. We listen for what works, and we listen for what doesn't work, and that's where we have a collaborative alliance to highlight things. If a belief doesn't work, if a bias is there that's not conscious, or if there's a blind spot, then we help the client be aware of and revise a story to work in a way that will be much more meaningful.
Mm.
Now, is that a workable answer for your question? Because it's a great question.
And I think so, and it kind of answers, you know, my follow-up thought of, you know, how do we avoid the why are you this way, right, as opposed to why, you know, what is it that you want to be and what are the behaviors, thoughts, and actions that get you there, right? So kind of reprogram that, is that...
Let me respond to that in a practical way, and I know we're over, and I'm going to respect that. I'll limit it to one minute if I can. Well, this is your chance.
Yes.
Any of you, none of you who know me, I'm going to put us on lecture mode because somebody. Okay, this is your last chance to ever hear me talk in under a minute. The reason that giving somebody information or facts or asking why questions never works is that whenever we present something, the listener or the reader will always compare it to what is already there that they know or believe. So if it's a belief, it's a fact, it's information, they're going to compare what they hear from us. And if it fits, they're going to find a way to make it make sense, confirmation bias. If it doesn't fit, they're going to find a way to refute it. And they're going to be even more entrenched in their original position at the end of that process than ever, and it's called the boomerang effect. This is why giving somebody information is never enough or doesn't work. If it would work, we'd all be thin, we'd have... we'd work out every day, we'd eat mostly vegetables, we'd have a lot of money saved up for the future. A lot of librarians would be billionaires. But giving information as well as why questions don't work, because why begins an immediate revision to someone's left prefrontal cortex, so they're going to tell you why. Now, it may not be cause and effect, but it's going to make sense, and it's going to lock them into a way of thinking about it that will foreclose openness and consideration, just like giving somebody a suggestion or some ideas about what may be better for them to do. Look at my, I think it's my next to last blog for a summary of what we just talked about. How do you help someone change their mind? It's on my my website, mentorpath.com, and I think the last tab at the top is blog. Just go to that, and you'll see that as one of the two more recent blogs. So thank you all very much, and if you have other responses to the things you'd like to cover, the questions, please send them to me. I value that, and it will make a difference. Thank you all very much, and I apologize about our time going over. Take good care of yourselves. We'll pick up right here next time. Bye now.